Hello and welcome back to Housing Japan, episode 3. Today, my guest is Alfie Goodrich, a British-born, Tokyo-based photographer whose career ranges from shooting the Duke of Cambridge to helping launch Hasselblad's most iconic cameras, a former music industry insider turned master visual storyteller. He's worked with everyone, from Time and Porsche to Lexus and the British Embassy. Whether teaching hundreds of students across Tokyo or capturing the soul of a city through his lens, Alfie is a creative force and a truly global footprint. And he's been kind enough over a number of years to lend his incredible talents to Housing Japan, shooting both still photography, videos, interviews, property features, and now podcasts. So thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome. I like the size of the check I need to give you for that intro. Just
I'll bill it later. No, yeah. You're welcome.
We must point out at this juncture that photographing the Duke of Cambridge.
Photographing.
Yeah, I got into some... There was some odd... I mean, I was on Twitter back when I did that shoot.
And
you get some strange responses and probably some odd people crawling through your feed when you say, oh, I'm just going off to shoot the Duke of Cambridge.
Due to that work.
Yeah.
Did he have some bizarre followers?
Well, no. I mean, I think probably I had the FBI following me, when you start. So, yeah, it was around that time I thought it might be a good idea to use the verb to photograph rather than shoot. Yeah, because I put up a post saying, I've shot the Emperor, the Empress, two princes, three prime ministers this week. And then
that's a lot of shooting.
Yeah.
Yeah, the FBI would be after you for that much shooting.
I photograph people. I tend to.
No, that's really good. Well, first of all, the inaugural question we have to ask all guests that come on here or that you come across in Japan. Why come to Japan?
Why come to Japan? Well, yeah. I met my wife in the UK because she has family there, but she's the reason I came to Japan. But my first trip to Japan was partly to see her, and it was partly work because the record company I was managing in London at that point didn't have Japanese distribution.
Oh, right.
And the label I'd been PR director for before, through them I had a good contact here for a Japanese music distributor. I came here partly to see the missus and partly to do a deal for my boss.
Wow. So at that time, photography and videography was not really in your mind.
I was doing them. I mean, I left art school a year early than I should have done because I just felt like I'd learned enough. And this is 1990-91. So, yeah, it was expensive. Wow. Film, paper, chemicals, rent, food. Yeah.
It's a lot more products than it is these days.
Yeah, cameras are expensive these days, but if you inflation adjust the price of a new Nikon now back, it would be cheaper than the Nikons were then. So, yeah. So, excuse me. I ended up in the music business through the warehouse and then a few weeks in the marketing department and then upstairs to the PR department. And, yeah, I had some good contacts. So, came here to do a deal.
Wow.
To get a distributor, and which I did. So,
and now it's all changed so much. So what transitioned you from working in the music industry and coming here to secure a sort of audio deal into such a visual, strong medium?
Arriving in the press office of a record company, because the guy's assistant had gone on a sabbatical. And then pretty much the first phone call I had at my desk as press assistant was a magazine asking for pictures of, could I send them pictures of one of the artists, you know. So at that point, obviously, light bulb goes on overhead. Yeah. Here I am as somebody who just done 3 years of four of photography studies. And I've been taking pictures since I was 5 years old. And that was my passion. And it's what I'd just spent 3 years doing at art school. Seemed like a good place to be sat.
Yeah.
Because I started taking all the pictures of the musicians we were recording in recording sessions and then shooting stuff for some of the covers.
Yeah, because your history of photography did go all the way back to the UK doing those festival shootings.
Yeah, so I was shooting quite a bit of music before I ended up in the music business just because I like music. And so a lot of what I was shooting when I was at college and in my own time was music. And then, yeah, you get into a record company, you start making other contacts. So then, because we had a world music label, I made some contacts at WOMAD and I ended up going there pretty much every year to Reading, and they had a lot more festivals in the UK at that point, Morecambe Bay and St Austell, and so I would go and shoot them and make the pictures available to WOMAD.
Wow. So bringing it back to real estate, because I have to, why did you transition from shooting the music and the festivals into architecture? Was there something that brought you to...
Yeah, well, so I left the music business 2001. My boss sold the company to a bigger label. We just had our first kid. We were living in London. We went back to Wales and I started my own business. So up until that point, music photography was pretty much all the photography I was doing. And I was getting published through the fact that I was taking pictures for the label and people would publish the pictures I took. And that was all very nice. But when you start your own business, you need to, I had to diversify. So I started basically doing all the things I could do. Bit of PR. I started representing a couple of musicians that were working, I was working with before in the business. Started doing web design. So the business I started was a bit of everything. So I obviously went back to photography because that's something that I love, and the client base diversified. So those first few years of having a freelance business were kind of take a bit of everything, and then you start developing a client base. When I came here, I decided to ditch a lot of the non-photography work I was doing and just concentrate on photography because I just felt new place. We had a little bit of a buffer of time and money when we came here so that I focused on just developing a list of photography clients. And then, yeah, the challenge is always like you don't want to diversify too much.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more of a generalist.
Yeah.
But there are things I don't shoot. But yeah, I like the built environment is very important to me as somebody growing up, and you know, the way your built environment affects you is very important, I think. And so real estate is essentially, it's just, I see it as the built environment. And when interesting real estate companies are making, together with architects, interesting properties, that's a nice thing to be shooting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So how did that connection with Housing Japan first begin then?
I got approached maybe 2015 to shoot some properties. I think a bit to begin with is, this is where the problem of being 56 years old comes in. Your memory starts to...
little fades.
Yeah, I can remember six license plates, my cars my dad had in the 70s, but I can't remember what was happening 10 years ago. As far as I recall, it was some rental properties or properties that you were selling on behalf of a client that I shot first. And then that developed into, oh, we've got this, you know, big luxury property that we've built that we're going to need shooting. So that first Gravitas was, I think, the first big project I shot.
Yeah.
Where you had the two next to each other in kind of Nogizaka, I guess that was.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it grew, you know. I then asked, oh, you know, where are you going to use these pictures? And one of the answers, well, we'll put them in this magazine we've got. And then,
yeah, that's going back and doing the research I did for this episode. The earliest kind of work I found was a 2020s article recapping sort of Housing Japan.
Oh.
For the 20th year, and I think going back as far as 2015 also, the beginning of the Housing Japan.
Yeah, so I was just having a smoke outside with your then marketing boss, and we were talking about, you know, where are the pictures going to be for... So he mentioned the magazine, and then he mentioned the fact that you guys were thinking of changing the style or revisiting the magazine. So I said, well, can I pitch for that, you know, because I was making a couple of online magazines at that point, predominantly not print, but yeah, so I pitched to take over doing the magazine, did I think six issues of it up to 2020. Through a couple of three redesigns I think along the way.
Yeah, and speaking of which, that brings us nicely to the New Lux magazine.
Yeah.
This is going to be obviously a podcast, very audio format heavy. Mm. So I recommend to anyone that is tuning in to go check out the video version on YouTube. I'm going to be putting a whole bunch of...
I must remember that camera's there.
It's right there. I'll be putting a whole bunch of visuals up on the video format for this episode.
Excuse me, my tummy's rumbling.
It's okay, no, go for it. Have you eaten?
I'll have some water. Have me water.
That'll fill you right
up.
Yeah,
it will, yeah.
But the Lux magazine also has a lot of online components. Mm. People can purchase online, view through the website or even in-app.
The full thing is online as a kind of flipping page magazine.
Yeah, so we'll dive into that more in a little bit.
Right.
First, I just wanted to ask more than anyone else, I thought I could get a free lesson out of this.
Oh, okay.
If that's okay.
I don't mind.
That when you visit...
Get them when you can.
When you visit a property or arrive at a property,
yep.
What do you consider is so important for shooting? Is there some sort of message you're looking for? Some sort of like key feature?
With any job, obviously, before you go and do it for the client, you find out what's important for them. Mm. Like, you know, there's obviously every photography job has a bunch of key shots. You're trying to tell a story, so there's a sort of a beginning, a middle, and an end. But there's a number of things you want to cover.
Yeah.
I mean, simply, obviously, outside, inside, and all the different rooms.
Yeah.
And I think, though, as a visual person, the one thing you get to a point with, which is really nice when it happens, is that you get to a point where you're able to walk into a space, whether it be an outside or an inside space, and knowing what gear you have in your bag, so which lenses you have, are able to walk into that space and be able to imagine it from every corner or every spot through all of the lenses that you've got in your bag.
Gosh.
Yeah. So that's pre-visualization. So I guess any job you're doing, whatever the subject matter is, pre-visualization is pretty important. Mm. You do it long enough, and I've been doing this quite a long time, you get to a point where it almost feels like a superpower. It's like an out-of-body experience, you know. I can walk into a room or an outside space and imagine it from many, many vantage points.
Mm.
So I think, you can build that by walking around a property and looking at it from different vantage points.
Yeah.
Obviously, typically with real estate, wide angle lenses are a useful thing to have in the bag.
Yeah.
But you've got to be careful with them because they distort.
Yeah.
If you point them up or down too much, it's going to distort. But they're a great tool because obviously you can make somewhere bigger than it is, which is obviously you've got to be careful about that too because you don't want to mislead people.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think so. The key thing is, which talk with the client about what are those key visuals, the things that are really the top line attractions about a property that other are going to sell it. And you make sure you cover those. And by the time you shot those, the place is beginning to sort of wash over you enough to the point where you start to see all the little things, but don't miss the details. The big pictures are important.
Get
all the little textures and materials and things like that too.
You brought up the Gravitas project. Shooting, do you remember shooting that?
I do, quite, because it was a the real challenge about that was that there wasn't much furniture in it. In fact, there were two. There was one next door which had a lot of furniture in it, but it wasn't, it just really wasn't going to work for the pictures. It was a specific sort of taste direction, so we chose to shoot the empty property.
Mm-hmm.
So we basically had to come up with a way of making it feel like the family just moved in.
Yeah.
So there were enough bits and pieces in the kitchen for it to feel like, that's a lived-in room. But the big living room was kind of, we had to shoot that on a mode of thinking these people have just moved in.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a big property.
Yeah, absolutely huge. Is a bigger property more challenging to shoot, do you think?
Well, there's obviously physically just more to get around and shoot. So you've got to be very focused on not spending too much time in each place, but you've still got to get everything. That's a constant challenge with photo shoots and whatever you're doing is being very focused, but then also being open to inspiration. But you've got to keep an eye on the timeline, you know, because so that's when it's useful to have an assistant or other people around who are banging the watch and telling you, you know, we need to move on. So,
yeah.
But yeah, I think the biggest challenge of that house at that time was making it feel lived in. So we had, you know, we had a male model and a female model, and actually my youngest son, who was probably about two or three then, four maybe, he was in the picture.
Oh, no, really? That was your son? I didn't know that.
Yeah. but I think the real challenge, one of the real challenges of that was making that room with the car that came down on the garage into that sort of glass window.
That was a stunning shot.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of stuff in the room. It was just the car, you know. So I think that was the biggest challenge there, was it wasn't a furnished property. We had to sort of make it look like it had just been moved into. And so we didn't really shoot all the rooms. We just picked a bunch of key rooms that were the wow spaces.
Yeah. Wow. Well, you did an exceptional job.
And thanks.
Exceptional job here on the Lux magazine. So you're listening
to
this.
Very happy with how that came out.
Yeah, no, it's an absolutely incredible, just complete collection of all sorts of luxury topics, but whether it's travel or more arts focused or, of course, real estate.
Thank you. I mean, the challenge, we finished shooting a big property for you last year, the year before.
Yeah.
And Hashimoto-san wanted a brochure. So I said, well, maybe now's time to think about bringing a magazine back, because that's sort of, with the right stories and visuals in there about housing in Japan, it becomes the best brochure that isn't a brochure that you'll ever have. So so we talked about that, and the magazine had gone kind of dormant at 2020, but quite largely because of COVID, which sort of changed the landscape of a lot of things, as everybody knows. We decided to bring the Housing Japan magazine back, but to rename it and kind of completely rebrand it.
With that rename and rebrand, was there a big topic shift for you? Was there a different sort of focus coming in with Lux magazine? What sort of differentiates it for you?
I think the key thing for us to get right was that it could have the stories in it about Housing Japan and about the real estate topic, but still be the kind of thing that people who are not necessarily completely obsessed with property would want to pick up and read. And that was kind of always the challenge with the last magazine, the change of format and making this a bit more stylish, I think, like the design of the magazine, and a bit more photo heavy. Yeah, the old Housing Japan magazine was quite text heavy.
Oh, right.
And I inherited the magazine as it was, and then we made some changes to the way it looked, but it remained quite a text heavy magazine. This is not a small amount of text in, but
it had to
live up to the title that we gave it. It's got to feel a certain way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think, you know, for the first issue straight out the gate, we've made it look nice and it has an engaging set of stories in it. And everything always grows and changes, and the next one will be a slightly different cocktail of stories. But and a big part of obviously how the magazine feels is what the paper it's printed on. And it was very important to us to get that right, but also not for it not to be ridiculously expensive, which it worked out very favorably in terms of that kind of quality cost balance. But it feels nice. And if you're going to make magazines in 2025, I think you should try and do it in a way that is sensitive to the environment. So we have FSC. The paper's from a mix of sustainable sources and recycled paper, but it's also printed with vegetable oil ink. So it's all about as eco as it could be.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine anything that could be more environmentally friendly.
Well, I mean, no magazine, but, or an online one only, because, you know, obviously, if the minute you're using paper, it is, there is a resource drain of some kind, but you just got to try and make as little footprint with it as possible. So it's fully recyclable. It's made with recyclable, environmentally friendly materials. And I think that's, and I think, you know, there's still an enormous amount to be said for the tactile experience of a magazine. And I think Japan is one of those few places where you can, but there are lots of magazines still here, and there is still a role for publishing.
So
finding the printer we did, which my colleague Masako found the printer. They're Japan based. They've been in Osaka 30 something years, and they do a great job. And they were really truly a partner who cares about what they're making.
Yeah, it's incredibly
and
important.
That
these
was
days.
Important to us.
Yeah. And to go a step further, even, you know, like we've mentioned, it being digitally online and that being, you know, possibly the most environmentally friendly.
Yeah.
But that kind of makes these physical versions even the more special, because there's a limited version, and this is the physical run, and beyond that, you know, that's
it. Yeah, we kind of, I guess, to paraphrase a film from 40 years ago with Nail and I, this is free to those who can afford it, but for 2,500 yen to those who can't. So if you find one for free, in the American Club or in a residence or hotel or an embassy, then you're obviously moving in a relatively decent circle.
Mm.
But if you can't find one for nothing, it's 2,500 yen, which I think is pretty good.
I think it's
for a 108-page magazine with some unique content in it. So the next one might be a bit thicker. It'll be a bit more expensive.
But, I look forward to it.
Yeah, I would like the next one to be twice as thick. But that obviously does rely upon some advertisers.
Mm.
And, yeah, I mean, the words editorial and advertorial kind of changed meaning a lot over the years. But we're looking for some people to collaborate in the magazine with us who want us to tell their story. And part of that is advertising. It can be an editorial. I guess it comes down to somebody buying some pages and buying our time to make something nice for them. So,
Well, there's no better place to be listed. And if they are listening, they should reach out and get in touch.
And it's bilingual too. So obviously we want it to be about things which are in Japan.
Yeah. You
know, cool people doing cool stuff somewhere in Japan. But it could also be about a company who is coming to Japan or already sells something in Japan but doesn't necessarily have a presence here. But So we've got some very interesting things going on for the next one. We do have some people interested, obviously, in advertising and things like that. But, anybody listening to this or watching who might be interested in getting in touch to have us tell their story, very welcome.
No, they absolutely should reach out. And I'll put contact details beneath this episode where they can do so.
Thank you.
No worries, of course. And speaking of finding those, you know, wonderful things happening in Japan, people or items, I wanted to ask, being more, I think, I hope that's fair to say, being more photo-focused and the imagery within the magazine, did you ever find that the imagery kind of led the narrative? Or was it more the writers found the story and then the photos followed?
I mean, the three of us involved in this, me, myself, Masako, Carl, we're all involved in a sort of multidisciplinary side of creation. So Masako and I both take pictures. She helps me on shoots with styling and people, movement. You know, she studied movement at art school alongside the other things she studied with to do with photography. And Carl has a past that is in advertising and writing copy and stuff like that. So, but all of us did a bit of everything
in
this magazine. Yeah. So, but in terms of, so I think we're all visual people. So, and I think, you know, your magazine has a picture on the front cover and you've got to entice somebody to pick it off the shelf or pick it up or keep it hanging around. So the pictures are obviously really important because that's how it looks. And some stories are just more visual than others.
Mm.
But it's important to have the right amount of words to go along with something. It depends on the story, obviously. You know, some things are more visual.
Mm-hmm.
Some things need more words, you know. Yeah. So I think each of those just organically sort of works itself out here.
Yeah.
We wanted some of the editorial to be a bit more, yeah, I think Musco's stories in particular are a bit more poetic, a bit more whimsical in terms of creative. You know, and her two stories are really telling a kind of an emotional, there's an emotional element to the stories, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those stories.
Yeah.
One person's interaction with nature and another person keeping the business alive.
Yeah. Talking about interactions with nature, one of the stories, the mini adventure through the snowy forests and landscape.
Yeah.
I myself being in a similar vein, doing a little bit of photography, videography, that filled me with a sense of dread, honestly, thinking about how difficult that shoot must have been. Was there anything within the Lux magazine that challenged you sort of creatively?
All of it, really. Yeah. I mean, in its own way, because between the three of us, we're designing it and filling it up and trying to get people to advertise and things. And so it's a lot of different things. Obviously, there are some big parts of that which we divide out.
Mm-hmm.
Carl takes care more of the advertising. But yeah, the challenges in terms of that story had its own challenges, obviously, because some things take quite a long time to plan, especially stuff like that where you're visiting somewhere and that's busy with clients and that you need to get certain parts of it shot because they're key to the story and you don't want to do it at a time when it's full of customers and it just ended up that we were in Karuizawa on the day of 2024 when the most snow fell in Karuizawa. So we knew the weather looked like it was going to snow, so I had made sure that the mini had snow tires on it, obviously.
Yeah.
But that created challenge, but it also created an amazingly wonderful fairy tale kind of opportunity to get that thing out in the snow. And it's four-wheel drive, and it's the top-of-the-range thing that Mini, BMW Mini, sell. But, yeah, it was my only complaint about that car is that the windscreen wipers stuck to the windscreen at one point because it was so cold on the way back.
Gosh,
it was like minus goodness knows what, and we're in a blizzard. So, yeah, but it was an amazing vehicle to have in that weather. Yeah. And I think that story turned out really nicely. I didn't want the car and the hotel and John Lennon all to blend into one story, but it felt nice that they butted up with each other and that we went there and shot it in the Mini because John Lennon, Mini, they're two pretty iconic, very British.
How much more British can you
things?
Get?
I know BMW own Mini now, but it's still...
No, it's still got a special place in every Brit's heart.
the genesis of that car doesn't really get more British. You know?
Yeah. And it might be a bit of a cheeky early question to ask, but do you have anything lined up for magazine part 2?
Some things were already shot. So we have a lovely story about a guy up in the mountains in Nagano who's in his 30s, got a young family, and he's basically bringing his grandfather's honey bee. He's a beekeeper. I'm sure you farm honey? I don't know. But anyway, his granddad was a beekeeper for decades and stopped. And grandson's bringing the business back.
Right.
So he has this, they're Japanese honeybees. So they're tiny and you only get the honey once or twice a year. It's not like normal honeybees where you're perpetually harvesting the honey out of the hives.
Mm.
Excuse me. This is twice a year, and it's pretty much once a year. And so we took pictures of him back in September, October, which is kind of normal harvesting time.
Right.
And the hives are not like the same sort of hives that you classically see. They're
not the classic square drop.
They are, but they're sealed with screws. You know, there's not a roof like you lift off and that kind of thing. So the bees are tiny, you know. So there were some challenges about shooting it because they're tiny,
yeah,
and they're quite mellow though. They're not like at you, you know, all on you, you know. So that
did,
was.
Did you have to dress up? In
we're dressed up in the whole thing, yeah. Which Massacre obviously documented with a few pictures from the iPhone. So one of those might creep into a blog article about. Yeah, it was fascinating. And we shot some nice pictures of the honey and the hive and the bees in here. Yeah. So that's a really nice story. And it's completely organic.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, there's that and the story we had in this magazine of the lady who was keeping her late husband's wooden handle making business going.
Yeah.
And the bee guy has led us sort of to a point where we think there's that kind of bringing something back from the dead or a business back, you know, relative has done and then hasn't immediately necessarily passed on to the next generation or just keeping something going that's important.
Yeah.
That I think will be a theme.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're getting more of an idea now of regular types of features we'll have in the magazine and that we'll even perhaps develop names for those series of features, you know.
It's more like sort of a touching human story.
Yeah.
Than it. Yeah. No, I think that's a great idea. That's something that people can relate to.
So the bee guy is going to be one of our nice, it's a visual, it's sort of a food, nature, farming. Yeah. There's all sorts of stories of people, I look forward to all seeing in
that.
One.
Did you get a sort of very tight macro lens for that?
120 on the X1D, yeah, the Hasselblad. So it's a mirrorless Hasselblad.
Wow.
And Masako has those cameras. She has a set of those X1Ds, and we use those together on shoots. And that one, the 120, it's amazing. You can get super close, and it's super sharp. But obviously, with the thing with macro is that the closer you get, the more things get magnified, and magnification reduces depth of field. So you've got to have light,
tricky. Yeah.
Because the more you need to stop the aperture down to make the hole smaller to get everything sharp, but you obviously need light. Less so light. We did take a flash with us to get some of the shots of the bees. You're backlighting the honey that they were sitting on, or front lighting it. And yeah, it's quite challenging. Gosh, but yeah, I think the biggest thing with doing macro is you can get stuck on either auto-focusing or focusing manually, and just if you're having to do it handheld because a tripod just doesn't make sense with time and flexibility to the subject, you can waste a lot of time with either the lens focusing or you focusing. So typically what I do is I go as close as I can and focus it, and then I vary the focus by moving my body in and out, you know, because that's just the best way of doing it. So it's easier to sort of manage moving myself than it is doing something else.
To shift the focus wheel.
But yeah, we got some great people. I was very happy with those pictures.
Wow. No, that's incredible tips as well. For those that have tuned in for great photography tips, because of course that will all be in the SEO of this episode, you own a company, Japanorama?
I'm freelance and I am me trading as Japanorama. So that's how I set myself up when I came here. The broad swathe of what I do here is typically predominantly photography, but I also do some magazine design and the web designer. Pretty much do that for myself now. I host a few things for some friends, but the other part of the photography for me is teaching.
Yeah.
Or mentoring. So I was going to lean into a few people.
You do some walking tours around Tokyo?
I do walking tours. So, yeah, for people coming here who might want to learn a bit more about the camera and find out some nice places to go, which are off the beaten track in Tokyo, 20 plus years of being here, I can, you know.
Got some spots.
Yeah, I like the back of my hand, you know. and people want to. I think the other thing that people tell me they get out of that experience is just being in the same physical space for me, walking around and seeing things that I see, or them seeing new things because I help them to see.
Mm.
It's difficult to teach people to see. Yeah. You can teach people to see better.
Yeah.
But I think you've got to have a sort of an inquisitiveness and a curiosity that is a bit like childlike curiosity, you know, to want to sort of discover things. And but so, yeah, it can be difficult to teach people to see.
Yeah.
That's really, you know, that's almost part of the gift that you get as a, you can, I think this is probably a good time to explain about over the years teaching and being online and posting pictures, but to get lots of questions from people. And one of the ones that comes up a lot is, oh, I'm trying to find a style, you know, how did you do that? And the first part of that answer really is stop looking for a style, because it will find you.
Mm-hmm.
And a style is basically an outward manifestation of taste.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing you can do is build good taste. Fill yourself up with good books, go to exhibitions, watch movies, whatever you put in, that helps you develop taste. And if you've got good taste, you're typically, if you find a method or mode of creation that suits you, whether it be a camera or whatever, you're outpouring that style. That's just a reflection of your taste.
It's incredible. With your permission, I'd like to, whilst you're explaining that, scroll through some of your photos on your website. Is that okay?
Absolutely, yeah.
Because scrolling through them, it is so evident that you have a particular taste and an eye for these things that I or the average Joe walking down the street would not pick up on. It seems like such a simple scene. You know, I saw some photos of an old man walking across a crossing street here on a random street in Japan. But the way it lines up, or the contrast, or there's something about it that jumps, that makes it different.
Well, I'm very happy to say that explaining exactly how that happens is not necessarily something that is easy enough to do, because a lot of it is just a reaction. It's like a natural reaction that I have to something, the world I'm walking through. But what I would say is that maintaining a sense of childlike curiosity is a really important part of being a photographer. And turning the ordinary into something extraordinary. In order to do that, you first got to be of the mind that something ordinary can be extraordinary. So it's not just you know, you can't capture something that's not there.
Did you have any memorable moments like that shooting real estate or properties within Japan?
Well, I always basically try to go and see the properties I'm going to shoot beforehand, but sometimes I don't. And even if you've been to see a place, you haven't necessarily explored every nook and cranny of it. But I think, the surprises, the nice surprises with shooting real estate come, I think, from just spending more time in a place, in a space, in a room, and just letting it sort of seep into you a bit more. And then, it's some of the properties we've brought props with us. We bring models and talent. Obviously, you have those big properties, you're getting fully, mostly all the rooms, but sometimes not all, but you're getting key rooms fully furnished and dressed. We then add some cars, you know, like in the last one, it was a Rolls Royce, a McLaren, Masco's little Fiat 500, which kind of worked out as maybe that's the kid's car or whatever, and then a Tesla. But we're bringing these extra props and people, a mom, a dad, a daughter in that particular property. So I think it's, the surprises come when all of that planning and all of the bringing together of those various elements happens on the day, and you suddenly see it all kind of, it's like planets lining up, you know. Once you get all those components in a room, or various rooms, this is what I said before about being super focused.
Yeah.
Super focused and professional enough to remember to bring everything and everybody that you need. But then when you get them there, and to have a plan, because obviously that's a lot of rooms to shoot in a day, but to still allow yourself to be open to the wonder of how all those elements just suddenly sort of come together, and it's like a vibration, you know what I mean? Like, that sounds a bit yogurt and sandals explanation, but it's, the things vibrate, you know. It's like, so you're talking about composition. For me, that's when something feels like it's now it's time to push the button. It's basically for me that's like a in being in tune.
Mm.
You know, like you could stand in front of an orchestra and there's 75 people playing different instruments, and if the violin, one violin is out of tune, you can hear it. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what it feels like to me when I'm composing a picture. Like,
wow.
Once everything's in tune, I push the button.
Yeah. God,
so the surprises with real estate come when you have all those elements which you've just sort of planned. You haven't put them all in a room before, and you put them all in a room, and suddenly it's like something that you didn't
suddenly
expect.
Worked. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, it's the magic of the cocktail, you know, the barman puts a little bit more of this in one night or whatever and suddenly it tastes different. It's a bit like that.
Yeah, it sounds like the only sort of thing that really comes with a wealth of experience.
Yeah, I think so. When having the right people, I mean, that's a team of sport, you know, you can't do it all on your own.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when that sort of kind of photography is approaching the amount of people and stuff involved that video does, you know. So we do both on the same shoot. But the stills, obviously, you're dressing a set and you're bringing in actors. And for me, very much, even when I walk around Tokyo, especially when I do outdoor car photography or fashion or portraits, I'm seeing the set first, and then I'm adding my actors or my props. And that's how I work with models. The first thing I'll do, even if it's just a normal person, I might be shooting a portrait of a guy who works in a factory. I'll shoot the scene empty and show them so they can understand what their background is. Because once you sort of see how I'm trying to fit you into onto my stage, you know, then that really helps people understand how they interact with.
Mm-hmm.
Or they just understand a bit, it just gives them another layer of... But yeah, I'm looking at the background first almost.
Wow, really? I never considered that.
The world is like a movie.
Yeah.
And... yeah, photography, basically, this goes back to how I got into it as I got interested in photography when I was like 3 years old, is photography is pausing time.
Mm.
It's time travel.
Mm.
And that was the hook for me at the beginning. I was 3 years old watching my dad put slides on this big screen in the living room of holidays that my older brother and sister had been on with my parents before I was born. Huge, still, silent, as opposed to the small, noisy TV. You know, that was fascinating, but it was time travel.
Yeah.
And that's still pausing a moment of life and being able to share it with somebody else. That's...
There you go.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Well, for world-class time travel, go no further than Lux Magazine.
Yeah.
Where is it available online, the URL?
Luxmagazine.jp.
There you go.
And there's a link off of pretty much every article to the online edition. So the online edition is hosted at Issue, but it's easier. People just go to luxmagazine.jp and they'll find that.
Do you have a favourite story, if I had to torture you for one, within this edition?
No. They're all favourites, yeah. Yeah, because
it is very evil for me to do.
They've all taken some emotion and there's been a journey. Each one's a journey.
Yeah.
Yeah. So no, sorry, I don't have a favorite.
No, that's perfectly fine.
Yeah, read them all.
Great. And if people wanted to contact you for walking tours or lessons in Japan about photography, that is?
Myname.com.
There you go.
AlfieGoodrich.com or Alfie.photography. There's a few ways of reaching me, but yeah.
They'll find it, and I'll link it below once again. Well, thank you so much for joining me.
You're very welcome.
And best of luck with...
Yeah, very much looking forward to the next one.
Yeah, no, I think we're looking forward to it even more than you are. It's going to be brilliant.
I'm glad somebody's looking forward to it.
They all are. Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, man.